Good morning, colleagues, members of the audience. Welcome to this Wednesday, June 5th, is that right, 2013, hearing of the House Committee on Higher Education and Workforce Development. This will be our final meeting of this session, so enjoy every minute of it, colleagues. We do have a very interesting hearing before us. We are going to have a public hearing on HJM 19, discussion of student loans in general, and then return to the subject of teacher preparation with Vicki Chamberlain, who's coming to share information from the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. And then just a few minutes, just kind of wrapping up, taking a look at where our bills are and talking about next steps. So with that, I'm going to open a public hearing on HJM 19. Rep. Gorsuch, did you want to present this?
Yeah,
that would be great. And okay. And as Rep. Gorsuch comes down, let me just say that this is a bill, you know, I'm sure you'll hear from him responding to some late-breaking concerns regarding federal financial aid. We had initially hoped that we could get this in time to actually have legislative action on it, but it's too late for that. So we're going to have a hearing on the subject, and I'll want to talk to you about perhaps a letter coming from this committee and from some of our colleague legislators. So, Representative Gorsuch.
All right. Well, good morning, Chair Dembrough and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Chris Gorsuch, State Representative for House District 49, which includes the cities of Troutdale, Wood Village, Fairview, and Gresham. I'm glad to be here this morning to speak in support of House Joint Memorial 19. This memorial calls on the United States Congress to support Senator Elizabeth Warren's Bank on Students Loan Fairness Act, which is Senate Bill 897. On July 1, 2013, the interest rate on federal subsidized Stafford loans is set to increase from 3.4 to 6.8%. If this does occur, millions of college students would see the cost of their student loans rise. Senate Bill 897 would prevent these rates from doubling and for 1 year would lower them to the 0.75%, which is the same rate that big banks are able to get from the Federal Reserve discount window. This one-year plan would give Congress and the White House time to work for a long-term solution to the student debt crisis, while the Federal Reserve would make funds for the student loans available to the Department of Education. The DOE would continue to administer the loans as it does now. We, as we've heard in previous testimony here, in the United States, we have a student debt crisis and we need to fix it. Outstanding student debt is now more than $1 trillion. And earlier this year, the Federal Reserve identified this mounting debt as a risk to household spending. Not only is rapidly increasing student debt delaying the purchase of cars and homes, delaying the economic recovery, it is preventing students from beginning to save for retirement. This is not only creating an immediate crisis, but a future crisis as well. We need to ask where our priorities are. The federal government is forecast to make a $51 billion profit this year from student borrowers. This is a sum greater than the earnings of the nation's most profitable companies and equals to the combined net income of the four largest United States banks by assets. In fact, compared to a benchmark interest rate, what the government pays to borrow money for 10 years, students have never paid more. So when the government pushes students to go to college, I would say inspires to, but pushes or inspires students to go to college, I believe that it has a responsibility to not take advantage of those students. That's why we tried to get HJM 19 through, and as the chair said, we didn't get to the deadline in time. So I still think this is a very important issue and that we should do what we can to support Senator Warren's attempts to alleviate this problem. So thank you very much for allowing me to testify, and I'd be welcome to any questions you might have.
Anyone have any questions for Rep. Gorsuch? Okay, seeing none, why don't you come up and you can ask the questions. You have to answer them.
Thank you.
Yes.
Do you have to go back down to answer?
I will. I'll go back and forth. Sure.
Thanks, Rep. Gorsuch, and thank you. Thank you for bringing this forward. You know, I'm thinking that it would make sense for us, before we take public testimony on this, to hear from the financial aid experts to talk to us about how student loans are supposed to work and how they, you know, how the program is set up. And then we'll take the public testimony for people reacting to this strategy for dealing with it. So I know this is a little unusual, but within the public hearing, I'm going to open the information hearing on student loans. And I'm going to call up Jim Brooks and Kate Peterson, please. Do you have anyone else? No. Okay, Mr. Brooks, I think I know which institution you're from.
I forgot my OSU tie this morning.
No.
whichever you would like to start, it's fine.
So I will begin. Good morning, Chairman Denbrough, Vice Chairman Huffman, Vice Chairman Harker. Thank you so much for the opportunity to come speak to you today and talk a little bit about student loans. My name is Jim Brooks. I'm the Director of Financial Aid and Scholarships at the University of Oregon. I have been at the University of Oregon almost 2 years, having served as Director of Financial Aid at a large flagship institution in the Midwest, previous to moving to Oregon a couple years ago. I have about 25 years worth of experience in financial aid, having started on it initially in my career, and I've been very involved nationally, regionally, and locally with financial aid programs, financial aid processes, and associations. So joining me today is Kate Peterson. Kate is the Assistant Vice Provost for Enrollment Management at Oregon State University, and then she will be speaking as well. In my current position, I manage an organization that processes about $240 million each year in federal, state, institutional, foundation, and private funds to students of the University of Oregon. This allows just under 25,000 students to work towards some sort of degree at the university. And so student aid is very important in the lives of University of Oregon students and in the lives of students from the state of Oregon all across the state. As a financial aid professional, I view my responsibility as ensuring that I assist Oregonians in attaining a post-secondary degree within the state of Oregon. I also see my responsibility as ensuring that, that students are knowledgeable and informed about the choices they make as they head into college and as they begin to apply for financial aid and look at programs, and especially with regard to student loans. I think it's a very important part of my job, and I think it's an important part of all jobs of financial aid administrators across the Oregon University system. Each institution has an office that's fully staffed that works to do their best to make sure students are informed and students are knowledgeable and help them make the right choices as they pursue an education. We're talking about student loans today, and student loans are very much in the news. They're a top item. They've been for the past year or so. There's no doubt that, that federal student loans are a huge component of the aid that many students receive across the country, not just in the state of Oregon. They, in dollar value, are larger aid programs than any of the other programs that exist, and so they're very significant. Across the Oregon University system, about 59% of the graduating class in 2011 borrowed under the federal student loan programs. That's an interesting number because if you listen to most of what you hear, it sounds like every student is borrowing and every student is borrowing very large and insurmountable amounts. But this means that about 41% of our students went through the OUS system without ever taking out a student loan. But obviously for those that did, it was a very important part of their aid programs. Students tend to borrow on more than one program. There is the federal Stafford Loan programs, which are the ones we've been talking about today. There is the federal Perkins Loan program, which is a smaller campus-based program. I should note that the federal government has not funded any money into federal Perkins Loan for probably about 6 or 7 years. So the money in the program is money that rolls back to the institutions based on previous borrowers paying back their loans. So it's sort of a revolving loan program. For graduate students, there's also a Graduate Plus program, which is the equivalent of the Parent Plus program that undergraduate parents can borrow. And so those are the programs that most of the students tend to use. As you are probably aware, the aid application process starts with the FAFSA, and that includes student loans. So students file the FAFSA, the information comes out to the institutions, and we then take that information and try to create an ideal financial aid package for our students. We start with federal Pell Grants, which is the largest federal grant program, and it's the basis of all financial aid packages. In the state of Oregon, the Oregon Opportunity Grant is a very important grant that serves Oregonians, high-need Oregonians who attend Oregon schools. And I know there's proposals out there to continue funding the Oregon Opportunity Grant that are being looked at by the legislature, and I would strongly support that. Institutions use their own money as well, as money they've raised through foundations and from private entities to help support students. And then the final thing that comes into a student's aid package is typically a student loan. Different institutions handle this differently, but at most schools, students have to indicate that they do want a student loan. And just asking for it doesn't start the process. The student has to go through entrance counseling, which means that they can go online, and different schools handle it differently, but the process is supposed to result in their learning a little bit more about the loan program, how it works, information on managing their expenses, information on their rights and responsibilities of the borrower, and this is sort of the first step of the financial literacy process that many institutions try to handle as well. Across the OUS system, different campuses handle it differently depending on their student populations. And so some of the campuses, besides entrance counseling, also look at debt management curricula embedded as part of their freshman experience. So you try to educate students initially. Financial literacy tools, loan repayment calculators, basically trying to put any information out there you can to make the process more transparent and to make sure students understand what they're borrowing and what their responsibilities are as a borrower. Students also sign a master promissory note when they get a loan, before they get a loan, and the master promissory note outlines the responsibilities as far as repaying the loan terms and things like that. And then at each institution, loans are multiply dispersed, and what this means is if a student borrows a loan, they don't get all the money up front. The institution disperses the loan across the terms that make up the aid year. So for a quarter school, for example, the student goes fall, winter, spring, they would get a third of their loan at the start of each term. And the money is dispersed then so that they have it to buy books for other expenses to help pay for college costs and things like that. A student can decide at any point that they no longer want a loan. The law says that within 2 to 4 weeks, depending on how you made the award, the student can return the money to the school and the school returns it to the federal government. Some schools will go even beyond that. So if a student gets halfway through the term and they say, you know, I really don't need this loan after all, I don't want it, take it back, then the school will return the money to the Department of Education. So students have an option to walk away from loans. They can also take one disbursement and then decide, I don't need any more money. I think I've got enough, I can make it through the year, cancel the other disbursements, and institutions will do that. So students do have an option to do that. When a student's ready to graduate,
Excuse me for a moment, Rep. Greenlick.
Does that happen very often?
It does occasionally. I wouldn't say it happens a lot, but we do have students who will come in and say, you know, I realize I don't need this much money. And we certainly encourage that. We always say to students, if you don't need it, don't take it. If you don't need it, don't even take it and think you'll stick it in an account and hold on to it for the future, because that tends not to happen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thanks, Ms. Brooks.
Once a student is ready to graduate or withdraws from the university, they also go through an exit counseling process where they get information once again on the loan, the amounts they borrowed, their repayment options, when their loan repayment begins, so that they're educated as they head into that process as well. I mentioned briefly the PLUS loan. The PLUS loans are loans that parents can borrow to help pay for their undergraduate students' cost of attention. The PLUS loans have basically flown under the radar a lot. I mean, families are aware of them. But the one interesting thing with PLUS loans is there are no limits on PLUS loans. So a parent can borrow up to the cost of attendance, and that's something that is beginning to get a little more notice because parents are beginning to borrow more to help pay for students' education. And the Graduate PLUS loans are similar in that there's not a cap that the student can borrow up to the cost of attendance. So those are loan programs that are getting a little bit more attention. And then the final ones, and we talk about these and we hear about these, are the alternative or the private loan programs. These were a very large growing loan program, especially before the recession. They were growing 25% to 35% a year. With the recession, as the credit markets tightened up, banks were finding it harder to find credit to loan, and so they began tightening up their requirements, and you saw the private loans begin to kind of level off. But those are loans, as aid administrators, we tell students to take as a very last resort. In the current credit market, or in the current interest rate market, sometimes alternative loans have lower interest rates than do the federal loan programs, and some students find that very appealing. The downside of the alternative loans is the interest rates may be lower initially, but they are not capped typically, and so as the market changes, they will increase. The other thing is that those loans don't have the protections that the federal loan programs do. So it may be cheaper initially, but if you run into problems later on, you don't have the protections that you would under the federal program. So we encourage students to only use those as a last resort. I'll share a couple numbers with you, and then I'll stop and let Mrs. Peterson talk. The Project on Student Debt provides information on student debt across the country, and I'm sure you've all heard this number. The average graduating senior in the class of 2011 graduated with about $26,600 in student loans, and about 66% of that class graduated with debt. So once again, it's not everyone, but it's a large number. In the state of Oregon, the average debt was about $25,400, with about 63% of the students having debt. Across the OUS system, our numbers were lower. It was just around $23,800, with about 59% of the students having debt. So in the state of Oregon, we're doing a little bit better, but our numbers are still high. Obviously, student debt is a concern for parents, a concern for us as administrators, it is a concern for you as legislators, and I appreciate that you are looking into this, that you're talking about it and thinking about this, and thank you for the chance to talk to you about it.
Thank you, Ms. Burns.
Good morning, Chair Dembro and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Kate Peterson. I'm Assistant Provost for Enrollment Management at Oregon State University. I've been in enrollment management for a little over 6 years. Prior to that, I was a financial aid administrator for 28 years. So have been working in the area of providing access to students for quite a while now. The issue of student loan borrowing and debt has, in fact, gained a great deal of attention over the last few years. And one of the concerns that I'm beginning to hear and that I actually share with other university and college administrators is that more and more families are opting out of higher education because of the media attention and, quite honestly, misinformation about student loan debts and the role that student loans play in paying for college and making college affordable. So our goal today in working with Jim and some of our friends at OUS is to really to provide some of the facts and kind of clarify that landscape in terms of the student loan issue for you and hopefully engage in a conversation that helps you to have a better understanding of what is the reality of the student loan programs and why it's actually a very valuable and productive program when it's not abused. Some of the reasons why we're hearing a lot more about student loan debt in recent years is that states have been unable to fund public higher education at the level that is needed. And students have ended up taking on more debt as tuition and other costs have risen and to offset the lower state investments. The multi-biennial recession meant that students were entering a much tighter job market. And so anytime the job market tightens up and jobs are more scarce, you see enrollments increase. And you see older students return to school at a higher rate. And many times they're relying on the Pell Grant and loans in order to afford to strengthen their curriculum in order to find additional employment. And students also took on more debt as we saw the increase in financial aid applications happen as the recession occurred. So at OSU, for example, over the last several years, the number of eligible financial aid applicants has risen by 50%. So there's more people in the pipeline that are looking for financial aid, and student loans definitely has played an important role in helping them to get back into school. The facts that I want to share with you really is going to be talking about a couple different aspects of this issue. One is what students are at risk, and where do we need to focus our attention in terms of any efforts that we can do in a collective way to try to address the issue. So many of our students, as Jim has mentioned, aren't taking out loans, and many of our students who are taking out loans are doing so responsibly. But those students that are most likely at risk for having a problem with indebtedness are those who borrow at levels that are above the high debt-to-income ratio that is prudent. Also, students who don't complete their degree or their certification and therefore aren't able to gain employment at the level they would have if they had completed their programs. Also, students that are unable to get work for an extended period of time after graduation and go into loan repayment are at risk. Probably a more difficult to address population, at-risk population, are those students whose families have little or no borrowing experience. So students that are first-generation college-going students have a tendency to be at higher risk for getting into difficulty with loans. And on the flip side of that, they also are more likely to avoid taking out student loans and working too many hours or attending part-time, which increases the likelihood of non-completion. There was a study released in 2012 by the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City on student loan debt nationally, and they talked about the average student loans being about $26,000, but the median is about $18,600. And so when we listen to the media notes on student loan debt, they always talk about the average, but actually I think the median loan debt is probably more informative in terms of how we address that and how we package our aid to students. The other tidbit that I thought was very important is that nationally about 25% of borrowers have under $6,000 of loan debt upon graduation. And then there's another 25% that have around the maximum for dependent undergraduates of $30,000-$31,000. So 50% are borrowing at a level that is actually considered manageable upon graduation, which is between the $6,000 and the $30,000 level. The other fact that is often overlooked is that the trillion-dollar loan indebtedness mark that is talked about so frequently in the media is primarily due to the increase in the number of borrowers, not because necessarily students are taking out additional loans. The average amount has crept up a little bit in the state of Oregon, but for those years where the Oregon Opportunity Grant were funded in a more appropriate way, we saw the average indebtedness actually go down within 1 year for our graduates, just based on the availability of the Oregon Opportunity Grant. So again, a very important investment on the part of the state. Another fact that is often overlooked is that financial aid offices certify students' eligibility for loans, but they are not allowed by federal regulation to limit the amount that loans that a student accumulates. There are annual loan limits based on the level of students. So freshmen are capped at a certain dollar amount for their freshman year. Sophomores a different amount, and on, but their aggregate limit is $31,000 for an undergraduate degree for a dependent student. And both OSU and the U of O have primarily dependent traditional age students attending our schools. But if a student applies for a loan and we believe that they don't necessarily need to take out the maximum annual loan, the GYMS office is not allowed to deny them that maximum loan. If they're eligible and they want the maximum, GYMS office has to give them the maximum amount. So we're not really able to limit the amount that students have on an annual basis, and that sometimes is not fully understood.
Mr. Chair.
Excuse me. Yes, Rep.
To that point, I teach at Mount Hood Community College, mm-hmm. and just this year, we're now getting a situation where financial aid sends letters to students and says that they're reaching the limit of their financial aid, and then they need to talk to advisors like myself to figure out what their ed plan is so that they complete. That's new, at least at our institution. Is this something that's been going on for a while and we just haven't done it?
Chairman Dembro and Representative Gorsuch, actually that is one of the activities that aid offices have begun to implement in order to help students understand where they are with their indebtedness, and that there is a cap.
Right.
Yeah. So the concern again is completion.
Right. Follow up. Mm-hmm. One other thing too, and you were talking about responsible use. Another thing that we had to institute at our school, I think it was 2 years ago, mm-hmm. was enrollment verification. So that if students aren't there that first week, then they get dropped off of the rolls and they don't get their financial aid disbursement. And the reason for that was apparently, tell me if this sounds right, that people were getting student loans but then not attending school and they were using the student loans to live on. Mm-hmm. Does that sound...
Chairman Dembro and Representative Gorsuch, that actually is a longstanding federal requirement that institutions verify enrollment. It's very fluid in those first week or two,
right,
when students are allowed to pretty freely drop and add courses, and so almost all schools that I'm aware of, certainly OSU, U of O, mm-hmm. have procedures in place to double-check ongoing enrollment during those first 2 weeks, and then they'll adjust the student's aid according to the level of enrollment. Hopefully they're enrolled in something.
Exactly.
Otherwise, right, they owe those funds back to the institution and or the federal government.
Yeah, and as I understand it, frequently the school is then the one that is stuck with those funds if they don't recover them.
That's correct.
So we were running up quite a large deficit just from people who got the money but then didn't attend, and then the school was on the hook for the money, not the federal government. So there's a secondary problem, which is the budget issues that schools face, and this was adding to the budget burden on many of the schools.
So if I may add, there's actually some variation on how schools can handle those situations, mm-hmm. whether they disperse the money, so they're going to be collecting
right.
from that student. But one of the options is for the student to have a flag put on their federal student loan record so that they're ineligible for any additional financial aid at any other institution, and
that's
then
helpful.
There's full force collections in terms of getting those funds back. I know at OSU we have a very low number of students who actually pick up their aide, realize that they're homesick or something happens in their family and they're leaving school, and we monitor that on a pretty much daily basis, and we've had very few students in a situation where they end up leaving school and not able to pay back their student loans. Some of the other sectors mm-hmm. have a larger problem, and it's just the nature of their student population and the mobility of some of those student populations.
And just to wrap up, it's not that we're insensitive to people's economic problems. It's just that it then causes a substantial burden on the college that's stuck dealing with that. So I think it says something really serious about the economy that we would have students getting into situations like that. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, thank you, Rep. Gorsuch.
Okay. So the question is, what can institutions do to curb the increase in student debt if we're not allowed to really control the amount of loans that students receive on an annual basis? And so we've had a number of conversations across the financial aid group within OUS and also the enrollment managers. And we've talked about a real strong focus on expanding education and consumer information and financial literacy. And we recognize that in the past, we've had the letters go out to students, current students, continuing students, talking about their accumulating debt and other ways to pay for college. But we're realizing now that we have to do more outreach and that we are certainly including information about reasonable and responsible indebtedness when we do our recruitment activities and financial aid workshops across the state. But we're also now doing training with our pre-college program staff, and we recognize that there are a number of programs in the state, like Gear Up, for example, that touches the lives of a lot of middle schoolers and their families, and financial literacy and planning on how to pay for college and the value and cautions on loan debt is included in those informational sessions. So in the policy that was submitted to, excuse me, the student loan debt management and outreach policy that was recently approved by the State Board of Higher Education Academic Strategies Committees really does focus on ways for us to increase education, and that includes the early outreach. Some of the issues that we are spending a lot of time focusing on is, again, the need to increase the state investment in the Oregon Opportunity Grant Program. We've talked before with this committee about the importance of grant aid and how that really makes a positive impact on families' decision to attend post-secondary education, but also in retaining students who have financial need. We also are recommending that we do more public outreach on the benefits of dual credit and credit for prior learning. We are advocating for improving early advising and degree planning. So your example of an educational plan is a really, really appropriate and a very good one. So we're really strengthening at the university level our advising and doing a lot more cross-training and advising about how to pay for college, how to stay in college, and how to shorten the time to degree by being very thoughtful on what courses that are being taken. Also, to continue to expand cross-institution program collaborations and to expand the use of instructional technology, and then looking for other efficiencies that would slow down tuition increases and, again, to increase completion rates. And my final comment really has to do with the Oregon University System is planning to hold a symposium on student indebtedness and affordability. The date is October 23rd, and a save the date message will be distributed shortly. Again, thank you for allowing us some time to share with you some information on the student loan debt issues, and I'll be happy to take any questions.
Thank you very much. Mr. Brooks, I have a question. You know, you touched on the difference between federal financial aid and federal loans, student loans, and private student loans. And I wonder if you could say a little bit more about that. I mean, the advantages of using the Stafford loan, for example, you know, over a private bank loan.
Okay, Chair Denborough. The answer to your question, I think, is more in the benefits for the student.
Yes.
Obviously, the federal loans are provided through the federal government. The interest rates are set by Congress, which means they are part of the law, part of the statute, and then that's part of what we're facing right now in rates that were set 7 or 8 years ago that don't follow the market right now. What the federal loans offer, though, are repayment options that probably are not available with the alternative loans. The alternative loans are bank-based. The bank sets a term. The bank sets the repayment terms. The federal loans, there are programs that exist to help borrowers with repayment. For example, income-based repayment is one of the income-based borrowing repayment is one of the newer programs that exists where a student's payment is not more than 10% of their income, that they can stretch the payments further, and then after 25 years, whatever is unpaid is forgiven. That's not an option in the alternative loan programs. There are some loan forgiveness options, depending on teaching and teaching in certain areas that are not available in the alternative loan programs. I talked to a student probably 3 weeks ago who had come to the University of Oregon who wants to go on to medical school, and he was there getting some coursework. He had gone to a private school in the South, and he contacted me because I guess he borrowed extensively at the private school, and he was dealing with one of the alternative lenders, and he says, they're telling me I need to start paying my loans, that I have no more options. I cannot push them back any further. And obviously, he's finishing a bachelor's degree and planning to go to medical school. And he says, they're telling me my payments are probably about $2,000 a month. What can I do about this? And the frustrating thing was I had to say to him, there's probably not a whole lot you can do about it other than continuing to work with them, asking them to be flexible because they are alternative loans. So. And then he ended up saying to me, oh, it looks like I'm going into the workforce then versus medical school. Mm-hmm. And I encourage him to keep working with them, keep seeing what options they would give him. But that's a big part of the difference, and that's why we encourage students to stick with the federal loans.
Mm-hmm. And just to follow up, I had a constituent coffee this weekend, and someone who came, who's a constituent, is also a he's a bankruptcy lawyer, and he was telling me that the state of California has just passed legislation that would, I think it would prohibit garnishment of the wages of people who have private student loans. I think garnishment is not done, or there's a limit for the federal financial aid, but that's not in place with the private. And so they're taking some steps down there to deal with that. I'll be curious to see how that works out down there. But I wonder if you've heard about any of that.
Yeah. Representative Chair Denborough, I know that the federal government is looking at alternative loans. Obviously, there are private sector loans. It limits what the government can do. But with the Truth in Lending Act, I mean, there were some things implemented to try and help students so that they didn't walk into these loans as blindly as was happening. I mean, I'm sure you all can recall seeing those commercials on TV late at night. You can borrow $40,000 free education, no questions asked. And that I would see those and cringe because there were students who would do that, who would go straight to those options thinking they were good options. So I think the Truth in Lending Act has helped in that it's forced banks to involve, to educate students a little bit more, to get a little bit more information versus just saying you can have $40,000 regardless. But
great, thank you. Vice Chair Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Some good things that I've heard here, and in some of the work that we've been doing and encouraging dual credits and trying to give students a jump start without getting into debt. Another thing that we've talked about a lot, which I applaud you and encourage you to do even more, and that's in the advising category, so that students really do have a clear understanding of what they're getting into, not just from the loan and repayment itself, but advising in if you're getting a BA in a career field that starts at $23,000 a year, you probably shouldn't take on $35,000 in debt to get there. And if they do, it's a personal responsibility issue and it's their choice. As long as they're well advised going in. One question, Jim, you mentioned the exit.
Exit interviews.
Yeah, the conversation. And you go over their finances, what they've accumulated, and what's going to be expected of them. Does that come out in a form that they need to sign?
Chair Denbro, Vice Chair Huffman, the students actually do a lot of the exit counseling online. So they do go through a process that they have to complete online all the way to the end. There's nothing that I'm aware of that they actually sign as part of this. We also give students the option to come in and talk to us as well. And we encourage students to do that, especially if they have questions, because doing things online, sometimes you don't get all your questions answered. When they do talk to us, we try to make sure that we cover all of that, that they're aware of what their loans are, kind of help them figure out exactly what payments will be. The downside of that is they're doing it on the tail end. I mean, my preference would be we're having those conversations day one when they show up for a week of welcome or something like that. But the process is not perfect by any means, and there is a lot more we'd love to do than you run into size and the capability and things like that.
Closing comment?
Okay, please.
Thank you. And I can appreciate that. As long as we're doing all we can to advise students in what they're going to be getting themselves into. And as a parent, I can appreciate that you do all you can. And, you know, my kids, I said, you know, if you get out with $25,000, $35,000 in debt when you get out of school and you get a job instead of going out and buying a new car or truck, set it up like you would on a five-year, you know, not literally set it up, but in your mind and in your finances, set up as a five-year auto loan and several hundred dollars a month and get that thing paid off as quick as you can. Nobody did that, but at least we had the conversation and they had the understanding, and not a one of them have gotten into difficulty because we did have that conversation. I think most of them have their loans paid off by now well in advance and have good careers, but as many as those conversations, and again, I mentioned parent involvement, and maybe a lot of students don't have that. I even have an adult child that's in nursing school right now, and she's 32, and I'm still involved in helping counsel her and how much debt to take on and what it's going to look like when she graduates. So, yeah, we do the best we can, but at the end of the day, it's personal responsibility. And
thank you. One last question, Rep. Wisnant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To follow on with Representative Huffman, Assistant Provost Peterson, you talked about having a seminar coming up. This committee has supported the Aspire program. The governor's put a lot of money in Aspire. That's where we really need to have the seminars before they get to the university. Look at return on investment. I think that student loan is an issue that is not going to be quite as bad as the housing problem, but it is, and it involves, we didn't have education, looking at what we talked about today as far as return on investment, how you're going to pay that off. So I think I will encourage the committee and the chair to, we need to work with Aspire to be sure they're doing, we give them money now to build that program up, and that's where you need to be reaching the students. Thank you.
Great. Thank you both very much for coming.
Thank you very much.
Okay, we have a bunch of people who have signed up to testify. We're going to have to limit you to just a few minutes if you can do that. That would be great. And so the first panel will be Ernie Garcia, Craig Rubicki, and Robert Phillips, please. Yeah, why don't you do 3 minutes, please?
3 minutes.
Okay, Ernie, you want to start?
Good morning, Chair Denbro, members of the committee. My name is Ernie Garcia, and I'm a student at Portland Community College's Southeast Campus. First off, I'd like to thank Representatives Gorsuch and Gagels and all the representatives and senators whose names appear on this measure, and the members of the committee for allowing me to speak in support of HJM 19. It's with a great deal of gratitude and humility that I appear before you today. I'm thankful to the federal government that it has made it possible for me to realize what has been a dream come true for me. And I'm thankful that I've had the opportunity to attend Portland Community College and be a part of such a great institution. At my age, I never thought it would be possible that I would ever have this chance to be given to realize my dream of attending college, and by that means to attain an even greater dream of mine, and that being to participate in this internship offered by PCC. But I still have a way to go before I realize the full measure of that quest. As a second-generation Latino, this journey also helps to fulfill a promise that my grandparents sought in coming to America, and as is the dream of so many immigrant families, to have the opportunity to provide a better and more fulfilling future for their children and the generations to follow. And education is the means by which a family may realize this progression. And through the accomplishments of my brother Ruben in achieving a bachelor in social work from BYU and then seeing his son Nathan receive a law degree from the University of Utah, a part of this dream has been realized. And now for me, as well as for so many other students across this state and across the country, I seek the opportunity to realize this dream as well. Student loans should be viewed by the government as an investment, something that will benefit not only students but the nation as a whole. Every day we read in the newspapers or in online stories, for example, about how this country is not producing enough STEM-educated individuals to fulfill workforce roles while we continue to extend work visas to workers from other countries to fill these positions. So I think I'll just cut it there and so we can move on, but I just appreciate the committee's giving me the opportunity to speak here today.
Thank you very much, Ernie. Yes. Great.
Okay. Representative Dembro, members of the board, my name is Craig Rybicki. I am just about to finish up my first year of education at Portland Community College. I am an intern with State Representative Ben Unger, and this Friday I'm going to be graduating from Glencoe High School.
You're doing it all.
Yeah, I know. So my parents... So my dad, in, I believe, 1984, graduated from UC Davis with a degree with a bachelor's in biochemistry. He graduated with just $2,000 in debt, and he paid it off within 4 years of graduation. My mom got a bachelor's in business administration and only had $3,000 in debt. She also paid that off within 3 years, a few years of graduating. Unfortunately, for me, that's not realistic at all. The reason I'm going to Portland Community College for the first 2 years of my education is because I don't want to have to deal with that massive amount of student debt. And this is the same for all of my friends who aren't starting out at a four-year and just planning to go for their associates and then continue. Right now, the average debt for students graduating from college is $24,000 for about 57% of students. And the even worse thing about this is that about only 53% of recent college graduates actually are employed recent college graduates are employed. So they really have no way to pay off this debt that they've accrued, and then collectors start showing up, all this bad stuff, private loans. And so I'm going to finish this up with, when I was young, the general consensus and idea that was told to me all the time was, be whoever you want to be. Go to college to do what you want to do. But now that I'm actually going to college, everyone's telling me, get a degree so that you can get a job so that you can pay off your student loans. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Craig. And it sounds like you're doing some very smart things, though, in terms of managing your future debt. Robert, tell us about your experience.
Chair Dembro, members of the committee, thank you. I'm a non-traditional student. I'm 29 years old. I graduated high school in 2001 and lasted a semester and a half before deciding college wasn't right for me.
I'm sorry, Robert, could you introduce yourself?
I'm sorry, yes. My name is Robert Phillips, resident here in Salem. I am a non-traditional student. I graduated from high school in 2001, and started college but decided to leave. I wasn't ready at that time, and in the interest of financial sanity for myself, decided to withdraw at that time and take a full-time job. So when I went back to community college in 2005, it was to get back into the swing of being a student. And I would not have graduated from my community college or the four-year institution with my bachelor's without student loans. But my issue with this, and the reason I'm supporting House Joint Memorial 19, is we are in a marketplace right now where both the federal government, as Representative Gorsuch says, is inspiring us to go to college. The market's demanding that we go to college. And there's a decent portion of the market, and I wouldn't say the majority, but a decent portion that doesn't care what you get a degree in. The number of jobs out there that my friends have applied to, that I've applied to, it just says four-year degree. It doesn't matter what it's in. It's not STEM technology. It's not business administration. It's a hoop you have to jump through. I worked in human resources for a national retail chain for 3 years, and screening resumes that are coming in for our managerial spots, I was hiring people with English degrees and music degrees for managerial spots who had very little work experience, and passing over applicants who had 10 to 12 years of work experience but no college degree. When you have a marketplace that uses these degrees as a hoop to jump through, not a qualification to do the job, they put us in a very difficult situation. I made the choice, and Representative Huffman, you mentioned it's a personal responsibility choice, and you're absolutely correct. I made the choice to go to a private four-year school for 2 years to finish up my degree, because that was going to provide, in my estimation, the best opportunity for me to advance in my field, which is political science. I took on much more debt than the average student here in Oregon or across the country to do that, and that was a choice. But when you look at the marketplace today, especially in the economic recession that we're in, you need to do everything you can to make sure you can get a job, and college is one of those requirements. So when I see federal government offering subsidies to companies that are making a profit, bailing out banks that had irresponsible practices, and I'm doing my best to act responsible. I pay my debt on time. I budget myself to make sure that I can do that. I sit back and I think every little step that we can take. This bill, Elizabeth Warren's bill, will not solve this crisis. But every step that we can take to make it a little bit easier for students to pay back their loans, to show them that we care much about what they're doing and their future as we do about, the institutions that have the high-paid lobbyists that can come into these rooms here in Washington, that's something that we need to do. And it is a personal responsibility thing. And the exit counseling and entrance counseling we take, to be perfectly honest, it's online, and it's a joke. I was not impressed. I mean, my parents taught me financial responsibility, and that's where I learned it. And, you don't always have parents that can do that. But the entrance and exit counseling, when you do it online, it's a bunch of multiple choice questions, and it's a couple of boxes you click, and that's not something. So that is need to be fixed, and I that's an absolutely worthy goal. But, as long as the marketplace is requiring us to go to college for any job, it's a responsibility among all of us to make sure that we're not creating more obstacles, we're helping to remove obstacles. So thank you very much for the opportunity to talk to you all today.
Thank you very much, Robert. Vice Chair Huffman,
thank you.
Quick question.
Thank you. Well, just a quick comment. Thank you for your comment. One of the things that I have been doing the last several years working with the Oregon Workforce Investment Board and the tech industry in Oregon is trying to preach, if you don't need a degree, don't require it of somebody, because you're adding to the problem that we've got with student debt in the state. And I've seen the same thing that you described, requiring a minimum four-year degree seriously to do that job. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Vice Chair Huffman. Representative Gates.
Yeah, I just want to make a comment. Thank you all for coming in and talking with us this morning. I do want to mention that Glencoe is in my district, so it's right next door. So go Crimson Tide. But I do want to make a comment about, I've heard this term personal responsibility mentioned a couple of times, and I just think we need to acknowledge that, yeah, certainly there's personal responsibility and personal choices, but there's also community responsibility, and we need to work together to really make sure that these loans are not so out of hand, and it's going to take all of us, not just, like I said, relying on personal choices.
Thank you very much. Thank you, all three of you, for being here. I'm going to call up Mike Sullivan and Bill Cluding, please. Here to give us the student perspective.
Man, ouch. Actually, Mike can give us the real adult
That's true. Chair Dembro and Vice Chair Huffman and Harker, you see Bill and I together a lot. Bill's had two hip replacements, and that's because we're joined at the hip.
You are a drag.
So yeah. Thank you. I'll talk to you later.
Oh, man.
For the record, my name is Mike Sullivan. I live in McMinnville, Oregon. By day, I usually do the political work for the Association of Western Pulp and Paper Workers, AWPPW. But I'm here today offering my personal support for HAM 19 as a father. Along with my wife, we have three kids, two that have graduated from college, and the last one's now a senior at the University of Oregon. This didn't come free, and it was a personal choice by my wife and myself. The costs were very high. We paid all the costs for all of our kids. We felt that was important. We want, you know, because the dropout rate for kids that work and go to school is much higher. So we took that on. My wife is a critical care nurse, 30 years of experience, head educator at Willamette Hospital. She decided to become a nurse educator, and Representative Hoffman, you better pay attention to this one. And she is now a nurse educator at Chemeketa. She had to go back and get her second master's. She has a master's in early childhood development because the nursing board wouldn't grandfather her in. So she went online 18 months working full-time as an instructor. And the grand sum of what she makes is going to be is one-third of what the graduating two-year nurse program makes. So, you know, that master's, like I said, took 18 months. We used to think of ourselves as a middle class. No, and I don't know how many middle class people there are left in this state, in this country. I personally worked 25 years, 50, 60 hours a week as a tradesman. As I said, my wife was an RN. Now we have to be concerned about our retirement. I don't even want to talk about Social Security, because I don't know anybody that can really just live on Social Security. So this American dream we hear of, the illusion of it, truly, for me, is a nightmare. You can't afford to educate your kids, and you can't afford at the same time to really do a full-blown retirement. And I'm not asking for pity. I'm asking you to ask your counterparts in Washington, D.C. to fix it. House Joint Memorial 19 is a nice Band-Aid, but it isn't. And Chair Dembro, you might remember I brought a resolution to the AFL-CIO convention probably in the late 90s called Free Higher Education for All. And I brought this same, you came and thanked me. That's what I wanted to remember, but I brought the same resolution, I think, in 2005, and Representative Buckley was very good enough to put it on the floor. Sitting up in the gallery for 3 days, and it was carried over, Representative Buckley came up, finally paid me a visit up in the gallery, and he said, "We just don't have enough votes." It finally came to the floor, and it was a bloody resolution, like Representative Greenlick does not like. It took 45 minutes to debate the issue. The issue was that it's an entitlement. Of course, it's an entitlement. It entitles our kids to get an education, pay more taxes, to have the kind of government that we enjoy. So in conclusion, Chair Dembro, it's nice, and I support it. But we need more, and we need it now. So I'm spilling my guts out, but it's because I worry about my kids' ability to pay for their kids, and so on and so forth. So thank you for your time, and I'll answer any questions that you might have.
Thanks, Mike. You raised very important points, I believe. Bill.
Chair Dembro, Vice Chair's Committee for the Record, Bill Clooding, Carpenters Industrial Council. All of touch this off with a little bit different angle. I want to personally thank the sponsors for bringing this forward. It's well needed. But I'll take you back a few years. The college is in Monmouth. Used to be OCE, Oregon College of Education. Excuse me. And we had a lot of working facilities in Dallas and Monmouth. And in the summer when these facilities wanted to pick up production, that was also the time that the workers wanted vacation. So we worked out a deal to where we allowed kids that was going to go to college, young adults that wanted to go to college. We let the companies bring them in, and our unions all agreed not to. If they went back to college that fall, we didn't hold out dues or initiation fees. Now back in them days, it probably a total of about $48. But back in them days, $48 was $48. But these youngsters came back year after year. And perhaps some of them, thrifty enough, was able to pay for one full quarter by just working through the summer. I don't have to add, I've brought this up many times, many different committees, but these facilities are all gone now. As Mike touched on, the middle class is just almost gone. But House Joint Memorial 19 is a start. We need education. If anything's going to bring this country out, this state, education is going to have to be it. And maybe back in the natural resources, we can do a little bit there, too. But education is a key. And thank you, Chair Dembro, for bringing this forward.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you both for being here. Okay, one last panel, Tiffany Dollar and Emma Calloway.
Sure, while they're coming up, that comment really took me because in our age, it was possible to find a job for the summer.
Yeah.
It's a part-time work that would allow you to put together money. Tuition was $97 a term, and you could really work your way through school. You didn't need to worry about that. The tuition now being so high and the really inability to find it's really hard to find a summer job that helps much.
Yeah, I'm not quite as venerable as you, but that was true in my time as well. I was able to do that, and it's...
By the time, 60 years ago.
By the time I was at Michigan, it was $400 a semester. Four times.
But it was worth it.
Absolutely.
Welcome, both of you.
Good morning, Chair Dembro, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tiffany Dollar. I'm the former student body president at this point of Portland State University. My term of office ended this past weekend. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today and give testimony. I want to talk a little bit about my story as a first-generation student who's non-traditional and how I kind of fall into some of those high-risk areas for people who often don't complete school and have more trouble with student loan debt, and then talk about PSU specifically because we have the highest debt load of any OUS institution in the state for our graduates, and then Emma's going to talk a little bit about some of the more national work that we're doing in reference to Senator Warren's bill. So I have debt over the average for a graduate in the state of Oregon, and at Portland State University, we have the highest debt load of graduates in the state of Oregon because we have students with the highest need. And just going off of some of the things that we've heard so far this morning, I kind of want to play off of those. Some of the concerns about not very many people being able to get a job within the first year after graduating from college, how there's no grace periods anymore in our student loans. So if you're not working immediately after you graduate, you are at very high risk for having problems with your student loan debt. For me, I was able to find a position. I'm working two jobs and trying to graduate right now, which is also really difficult and is something that we talked about earlier with first-generation students often taking on too many responsibilities. And so that's a concern because we know my parents definitely weren't able to counsel me on responsible borrowing. Unfortunately, that wasn't something they could offer me. As a first-generation student, I was really unfamiliar. I paid for the first year I went to school out of pocket, some of it with the money that I was making and some of it with credit cards. And I was able to pay all of those off once I was able to file as an independent student. But my first year was really tough, and I went part-time and kind of defied the odds and moved into university. And the reason why I think that's really important is because we talk about traditional students not as often having problems with their student loan debt. But we know that we're trying to appeal to more students who aren't the ones who are traditionally going to college. When we talk about 40-40-20 and we talk about the folks we're needing to recruit to meet those goals that we've set as a state, we need to be talking about those students who are at really high risk to have those problems with their student loans, and who really need the extra support and how to responsibly borrow money to go to school, because our first-generation students, our returning students, don't necessarily have that toolkit readily available to them. So that's something that I think is really important. And then the average student loan debt at PSU, the 26,000 number that was mentioned earlier, if you don't have a job and you don't have a grace period, that's not a very reasonable amount of money to be paying off right away. And so I just really want to bring that back. I have a temporary job over the summer, which means I have 12 weeks to find another job. And my student loan payments start like next month. So that's very stressful, and it's something that has a big impact on decisions I make around the positions that I can accept, because I want to make sure that I can pay off those loans, where I can travel to take those positions, and the financial risks that I'm willing to take to move my career forward, because that's a constant reminder weighing down on me of kind of like, how am I going to move forward? What is moving for a job mean for me financially if I don't have a lot in savings because I'm paying down these loans because I don't want them hovering over me for very long? So I think those are conversations we really need to be having, not just at PSU but statewide, because we are trying to recruit more of those students around the state who aren't traditionally students who would attend. Our loans are managed by, you know, the federal government, and we want to make sure that we're being responsible with that money, but we also want to be sure that we're treating students fairly. So we really need our elected officials, even here in Oregon, to get into this conversation, get ahead of the student debt bubble, and please support students and sign on to a letter of support for this bill. Thank you.
Thanks, Tiffany. Emma.
Good morning, Chair Dembro and members of the committee. I'll be brief. My name is Emma Calloway. I'm the Executive Director for the Oregon Student Association. And you're going to hear a little different sentiment coming out of students for the next couple weeks. You may be getting phone calls from students around the state really asking for you all to have conversations about revenue creation and PERS changes, because students are very, very concerned about the growing the lack of investment within our university system. And so we're going to be having conversations, and we are having conversations on our campuses all the time. And we think that it's a good opportunity to sign on to a piece of legislation like this, because this legislation is an opportunity to ask our federal government to play a significant role in talking about student loan debt. Personally, I came out of college with $25,000 in debt. I worked two jobs all through college. I lived on campus and worked on campus in order to not have any housing expenses, and I still came out with considerable debt. I think that this is a bill that that's about having conversations about student loan debt. $30,000 is not a manageable number, as mentioned this morning, and we can be doing better by our students with signing on to a piece of legislation like this. So thank you very much, and we hope that you continue to support this bill on a federal level, and really work together over the next couple weeks to kind of move past the partisan gridlock that's even happening in Oregon right now and come up with a better higher education budget for all of us. Thank you.
Thank you, Emma. Thank you both for coming. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on HJM 19. Colleagues, we will get back to you over the next couple of weeks or week or something about a letter, see if you can sign on to it with respect to this federal issue. I'll also close the informational hearing on student loans, and I will call up Vicki Chamberlain, please, for what I'm sorry will have to be a brief informational hearing on PSPC's role in teacher preparation. Thanks, Vicki. Thank you for your patience.
Good morning, Chair Dembro, members of the committee. For the record, Vicki Chamberlain, the Director of Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, and thank you for the invitation. So the question that was posed to me was, what is the role of teacher preparation and proficiency education, ESOL, special education, and then finally policy development? So I picked my two favorites, if you don't mind, and that would be proficiency education and policy development. So before I start, I'm recommending to you, as any good teacher would, a book to read. It's called Inevitable Mass Customization Learning, and it's about proficiency education and what it would take to change how we're doing business right now in order to get to our learner outcomes, which I think is the million-dollar question, because proficiency education is a combination, right, of knowledge plus skill and then applying it to real life. And the challenges that we have are overcoming the way our classrooms are structured, granting credit, giving grades, and grade levels. So we're doing licensure redesign right now. That's part of what the commission does. And you have to think, do you really want to lock your content experts into teaching only 9-12? California and some of the more progressive states are actually going, no, that's really pre-K-12. And then that knowledge base can be assigned up and down the spectrum as the district finds that the person is able to teach, as one perhaps example. But I couldn't resist when I was listening to the good old days. I worked in the cannery to go through college, and my tuition at Mount Hood was $90 the first term. But also, I was able to challenge classes, right? Which is sort of a model of proficiency education. And in the 70s and late 60s, when I was going to high school, you could take independent study. So I completed algebra in 3 months and then took like 2 years to do geometry. But I think that the point of that is all our learners learn subjects at a different level. So I have one quick analogy. I've cut this way down for you. If you think of it this way, proficiency education is precisely like learning a sport. And I used to be a tennis coach. So if I'm going to be a great tennis player, I have to serve, volley, you know, forehand, backhand, keep score, do my speed, you know, overhead, all that ball control. So if you go out and you practice, you don't practice everything. You practice on your serve if you don't do your serve well. You practice on your volley if you don't do your volley well. This is what we need to do in education. We need to assess precisely what the child knows and then let them work in the areas where they need to achieve. So the investment has to be in developing those known outcomes and the rubrics to measure how to get there. So we know. So if that precocious child has mastered Algebra 1 when they're 10, are we supporting them so that they can move up through that? Because they may be reading at grade level 5, right? So anyway, I will tell you, I believe our teachers in that situation can do the job because they know what the curriculum is, just like any great professor, and they know how to adapt. What they don't have are the resources and the support to customize and tailor the education for each child. So that's the challenge. That's my bit on proficiency. But in policy development, I think teacher preparation could have a very valuable voice, particularly here at the legislature. They've had a long-standing voice at the commission. They're probably our biggest stakeholder. They're certainly our biggest attendees at meetings. But if our partnership is the educators they prepare, the K-12 schools, the university system, the legislature, and it is, because all of the commission that I serve's power comes from you. The scope of what they can do comes from you. And then how we accredit the universities comes out of your grant of power to the commission to oversee that. So we have a relationship. So they are our preparers of our professional education workforce, and just like you would listen to nurses in nursing prep programs. So the commission has a role, but the teacher prep programs definitely have valuable insight because they're in the classrooms all the time. And they're... Finally, I would just say that I think the only way we can get there with proficiency education is to really look at how we're doing regulation, even from the commission level and otherwise, and make sure, because you have to be adaptable, and too much regulation actually makes that more difficult. That's my quick... Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair. Thank you. I really appreciate that, Vicki. Yes, of course.
Vicki, what is the author of that book, Inevitable?
Yes, yes. Charles Schwann, S-C-H-W-A-H-N, and Beatrice McGarvey, M-C-G-A-R-V-E-Y.
The title?
It is called Inevitable, Mass Customized Learning, Learning in the Age of Empowerment.
And just quickly to add, when I went through PCC, in the late 70s, $90. And with books, it's about 150 a term.
Yes, the good old days.
We're in a new day.
Okay.
Thanks.
Is that helpful? I don't know. It is,
Vicki. But, you know.
Exactly.
Do you, for things like proficiency-based education, do you see any limitations that... are statutorily based, you know, where it would help us to, you know, be loosening, giving some more flexibility, and it, you know, is there a path to get a set of recommendations from those practitioners, either through TSPC or in some other form?
Chair Dembro and members of the committee, I think the spotlight needs to be on what's going on right now in the K-12 schools, because we have X number of hours of instruction required at different grade levels, right? And we have the, if you look at what's called Division 22 in ODE, that is, and if you look in ODE statutes which structure the school day and the expectations, I think that you're going to see your charter schools, because they've been liberated somewhat from some of these regulations, are doing more in proficiency-based education. Mm-hmm. So I know school board members and other, we have to really do an assessment of the regulation and say, are we really getting our bang for the buck? But I think that real constriction on hours of instruction, days of instruction, school calendars, maybe you can provide incentive for models for people who, not just charter schools, don't necessarily have to go charter, but some kind of grant of flexibility in that regard. I think that's a place to start.
Thank you. Rip Gallegos.
Vicki, thank you for coming. I just have a concern that I voiced before, and it has to do with teacher preparation, or maybe the lack of preparation in terms of behavior management. I mean, I was at a thing the other night with some Beaverton school teachers, and this one math teacher brought out his phone to show me a picture, but he had to use the Vista function in order to get all those students. He had 50 students in his math class, for crying out loud. Mm-hmm. And so I said, do you do any one-to-one? It was a joke. The point is that teachers are so overwhelmed with those numbers. They don't have time to really teach. Or how do we deal with that, I guess, is my question.
Chair Dembro and Representative Gallegos. I think you actually defined the issue clearly in the end, and that is either we have to provide more support to teachers in large classrooms like that. I had 50 fifth graders to teach PE once years ago, and it took me 2 weeks to teach them how to sit in squads. So, I mean, you can't do it. And it's not a lack of knowledge of behavior management. It is in those kind of numbers with that kind of energy. It's almost impossible to deliver instruction. But if we were able to restructure and tailor education so that not everybody's doing the forehand on the same day, or everybody's doing that equation on the same day, and kids were more invested in what they were learning, you'd get that trade-off this way, and it becomes less of a management issue, and with the student-guided instruction. So I think there's two issues that come together. Help the teachers do the customized guided instruction, and more support for getting there.
Rep. Johnson.
Vicki, could you touch a bit about on how the coming of the Common Core State Standards is impacting your work in terms of teacher standards and practice and so forth, certifying what's the skill set, what type of practicums, methodologies that teachers have to be skilled in?
Representative Dimbro and Representative Johnson, well, one of the things that we did at the commission levels, we were the first state in the nation to adopt teacher licensure tests that were aligned with the Common Core. So right now, all of our math and English language arts tests are 100% aligned with Common Core, and then science also is being reviewed as that's coming on board, which is the first step. Make sure that they have the knowledge base. And then as the commission, we're working with the ODE, and I know higher ed is also working very hard in terms of identifying those essential skills that are required to acquire that knowledge in the Common Core and incorporating it into the teacher prep program. So we thought it was a really good start for us to be ahead of the rest of the nation that way to make sure our tests were current for the knowledge base, which is the big deal, which is the big ramp up.
Okay, thank you.
And I think just following up on that, you know, one of the things we've not had time to do this session is really do a briefing on the Common Core and the role of higher education in the Common Core. We certainly will do that during the interim. It's very, very important. Thanks, Vicki. Thank you for your patience.
No problem.
And for
my
your
pleasure.
Help.
Thank
Great.
You.
Okay, with that, I'm going to close this informational hearing on teacher preparation. Colleagues, we don't really have time to go into the status of the bills. You do have on your in front of you the bills of ours that are in Ways and Means. This list also includes the Senate bills that are in Ways and Means, and then most of our bills that are in Ways and Means are in the Education sub. A couple of them are in the Transportation Economic Development. Those having to do with apprenticeship. As you know, things are going very slowly down there in terms of policy bills, but we're hoping that things are going to start moving in the next week. So I'll keep you informed on that. The other sheet that was just distributed, which talks about what happened to our bills that went straight over to the Senate, you know, there you'll see, we have been able to have a lot more action. And almost all of our bills have passed. A couple of them had subsequent referrals down to Ways and Means. Two of them did die over there, if I can be blunt. But most of them got through, and that I think is a good thing. On the issue of higher education governance, which consumes so much of our time. We did have a public hearing on 270 and 3120, and the hope is that we will have work sessions on those bills within the next week, but I'll let you know more about that. Negotiations are still going on. There's a work group that is trying to reconcile any differences between the two bills, and we're hoping that all this will be resolved in the next 48 hours or so. So, finally, you got my note about the party next Tuesday, and I hope you can all make it. The invitation is extended not just to committee members, but to those who have suffered through this session with us at 8 o'clock in the morning. We'd love to have you there.
I think you ought to invite Bridget. She suffered a lot in this session.
Well, we shared the suffering with Bridget. But yes. Yes, of course, Bridget is high on that list. Yeah. Actually, that whole last row is high on the list. So.
Where's your duck out?
Anyway, you'll hear more about that. It's going to be at the Brick down the street, and should be fun at the end of the day. Okay, so with that, colleagues, we're adjourned as a committee. Unless something really exceptional comes up, this should be it for us.